that we wanted
This
to make it
call is being recorded.
A comfortable situation for people. So if you go to slide 14, I just wanted to show you how our waiting area looks here. So you come in, if you're there for one of our recovery appointments, we include here, this is where you are at the waiting area, and then if you need specialty care, behavioral health, or primary care, we direct you from here. And again, the intention is it's a one-stop shop, so you actually can go through our clinic and can get any care that you need, even age-appropriate screen exams like mammograms or DEXA scans, because we want to be able to provide you with the array of services that you might need. So if you're recovering from COVID, you don't have to go somewhere else for a different type of medical service. You can get everything you need, part of your with respect to your recovery or age-appropriate preventive care and primary care under one roof. Slide 15 just shows the outside of the building here. We were just excited about the fact that we've been able to open them so fast. So here's what it looks like. So just to summarize very quickly here, and then we'd love to answer any questions. We wanted to create these centers, again, thinking about the fact that more than a third of people with COVID will become long haulers. And to put everything under one roof for your recovery from COVID, from pulmonary function tests to diagnose lung conditions, to a specialized mental health intake with an array of providers providing those specific mental health services, all under one roof. We're wrapping this around comprehensive primary care, so you could bring your family. And we have age-appropriate screening exams ranging from mammograms, DEXA scans, to you name it, all under that one roof as well. And in this one-stop shop, if your family needs anything else related to COVID, whether somebody is symptomatic or needs to be tested, we have different entryways and we have negative pressure rooms, including special air filtration rooms for dental services, so that we can truly provide you and your family with everything you would need for comprehensive primary care and your recovery from COVID all under one roof. With that, it really is a privilege and honor to be joining you all today. Would love to answer any questions or hear any feedback you might have, and would be very, very happy to be in touch after this call at any time. And I hope that what we're doing in New York City is helpful to our country as we're thinking about how to get us all past this COVID period so that we can all live our healthiest lives. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Long. Really appreciate you joining us. We now have, we want to open up the floor for a few minutes just for folks to ask questions before we move on to our next presentation. So if you have a question, you can unmute your line by hitting star twice. And we just ask that you introduce yourself and if you can, just share what city you represent before you ask your question. So with that, we are now open for questions. I'll go ahead and just kick it off. I'll start with one question and then just really want to encourage folks to jump in. Again, you just need to hit star twice and introduce yourself. So I will kick things off asking Dr. Long just one question that I have. I think many folks can relate to this, but part of a challenge of, you know, opening something brand new is engaging community members, ensuring that people know about your services and that you're getting folks through the door. So would love to learn a little bit about how your team is engaging the community, what kind of outreach strategy you're employing, particularly in this environment, pre or post opening.
Yeah, it's such an important question. Pre-opening, we engaged the community to know where healthcare services were needed the most, and in particular, where people could easily get to and were identified as areas of confluence for that community, where public transit went to, all of those things. So that's how we initially set out to select the locations. But now, especially in the Bronx, now that we've opened there, the Bronx, right where we opened the site, is one of the areas that has been hit hardest by the coronavirus. So what we're doing is we're going out into the community. We're asking for people to help us to get the word out, to make it easy for people to schedule appointments into our clinic, to even walk in to make an appointment. And we've had people just come through the front door wanting to check it out, and they leave the building with an appointment. So our hope is that we can prove to the Bronx community at our first site here that we have something very valuable for them, and that we really care about them and their families, and that we want to provide these services to them. And, you know, we're only as strong as the voice of the community and how much they trust us. And we're hoping to gain that trust, and we plan to work very hard to get it.
Great. Thank you. Very helpful.
I have a question. This is Margarita Chavez Sanchez from Bernalillo County, Albuquerque, New Mexico. The biggest issue we see in kind of that mental health space is the workforce, right? So I'm just wanting to hear about your strategies to recruit behavioral health providers to be able to meet the demand in the community.
Yeah, a recruitment of not just behavioral health providers, but primary care providers is a constant challenge for us. So what we've done in our system is we've done our best to create a bit of a movement, if you will. We have Docs for NYC, and that includes for primary care doctors, but also we have a new behavioral health movement, if you will, that we're trying to use through social media to get people excited about what we're trying to do in our system, and in particular for our new sites here, so that we can attract social workers, psychologists, and psychiatrists to be a part of what we're doing. So far, so good. We've so far been able to recruit the people we need to get everything off the ground. But I think your point is completely right, which is that as we expand mental health services in these sites and beyond, we are already thinking about the challenge of continued recruitment. So if we have any, if we're able to solve the recruitment puzzle for behavioral health, you'll be my first phone call, I promise. But it is something we're thinking a lot about.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Other questions from participants? Okay. I will just pose one more question to you, Dr. Long, and just see if anyone wants to chime in before we move on. Just having gone through this process in such a short time frame, having opened one of the centers of excellence in the borough of the Bronx, can you talk a little bit about some lessons learned along the way and things that you all are just keeping in mind as the situation continues to evolve?
Yeah, I mean, flexibility is the main thing. So for us, you know, we actually been able to construct these centers remarkably fast over a matter of mere months. What that's enabled us to do is to take a close to current level of understanding of what the science shows us are the consequences of COVID and embed them into clinics. But of course, the science will continue to evolve. And as we find out what other consequences, mental health and beyond, are arising from the coronavirus, we have every intention to remain flexible enough to be able to incorporate them into our centers of excellence. So we have our eyes on the literature. We do know that, you know, if you look at SARS and MERS, other coronaviruses from 10, 20 years ago, that there may be other long-term consequences that do arise over time. And we are, I would say that we have our eyes wide open, looking at the literature, and are prepared to adjust our model based on where the evidence goes. And that's an important, I think, tenet of everything that we're doing here in terms of how we've localized the services we have so far.
Hi, this is Jocelyn from DC. I do have a question.
Hi.
I wanted to know, among survivors, do you have any support groups that's led by survivors or any type of peer specialist that's leading any support groups as far as cultivating treatment?
Great question. So when we were designing our centers, we did ask members of the community what some things that they would value in the centers would be. And one of the things that they said was exactly as you just said, how can we think about support groups for people going through grief or have otherwise been affected by the coronavirus? And so what we're doing in our center, and this is something we're building out now, we just opened our first center a matter of weeks ago, but we've intentionally built out space to allow groups to participate. Now we're figuring out what how we want to kick off those groups. So your point is exactly right on, and I'd actually would love to hear if you have further thoughts on our approach to what some of the things that the groups, from your perspective, or things you might have heard, should tackle first. That's the process we're going through now. We have the space, we have the intention, we've heard the community, and the next step is to actually start to execute on it. So if you have thoughts, I'd love to hear them.
I don't have any thoughts. I just know here we have centers, and what we're hearing from our certified peer specialists is that a lot of our consumers that are receiving services, they really want to have a space that they could share their stories with people uniquely that look and feel and have gone through things like them, and to really rally support from those who are actually going through or have been through, to really use that in collaboration with treatment with licensed clinicians. So that was just
that sounds dead on. I thank you, and I that's one of the areas where if there is an opportunity after this call, I'd love to keep in touch on that. And I've heard the same thing from our community. So we built out the space, and now we're at the stage where we're starting to do these things. So we'd love to share our experiences and hear more about yours as we move forward. That, if possible, that'd be great.
Yes, it is. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Any other questions before we move on to our next presentation? Okay. Thank you again, Dr. Long, for joining us, and thanks to some of the folks that have shared some really great questions. We will now turn to our second presentation, which is from some great leaders in Albuquerque and Bernalillo County in New Mexico. And these are folks who have been really leading the way with new and improved mental health, drug treatment, and support services in their communities. Just for folks who want to follow along, we're starting at slide 16 in the presentation. So to lead us into that presentation and introduce her colleagues, I'm very thrilled to hand the floor over to Bernalillo County Manager Julie Morgas-Baca, who over the last five plus years, has really overseen significant progress to provide better services in behavioral health, as well as other areas, and has really made a concerted effort to partner with other governments and nonprofits to really build a stronger safety net for people who need support. So very excited to have you with us. And Julie, the floor is yours.
Thank you. Can you all hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay, awesome. So first of all, I just want to thank you all for welcoming me to be part of this discussion. And I just want to say that I applaud and appreciate all that the coalition is doing. So again, my name is Julie Morgas-Baca, and I'm the county manager for Bernalillo County in New Mexico. And so our Department of Behavioral Health has been at this since 2014. So our commission basically went to the voters, and they approved a gross receipts tax a tax increase, and it's basically dedicated to address the behavioral health needs in Bernalillo County, which also encompasses the city of Albuquerque. So our goal is to address gaps in the continuum of mental health services. And as you all know and have experienced, COVID-19 has definitely exposed like another layer of these gaps when facing a public health emergency. Also, we're proud to say that we've got some great partners in the city of Albuquerque, and we've always worked collaboratively to address community concerns and further our reach and impact. And so this collaborative approach has been extremely valuable during this last year. So as you all know, there's really strength in numbers, and we can't do this alone. So we have a lot of really, really good partners. And we also partner with our public hospital, the University of New Mexico Hospital as well. And we've been able to get so much done because of these very important partnerships, as well as with the state of New Mexico. So, and, you know, again, as you all know, you know, navigating this this issue with the homelessness hasn't been easy. And so the city of Albuquerque has stepped up, and they're operating the city's largest homeless shelter, and it has stood up they've increased it to they've expanded this to get some wellness hotels out there in response to COVID-19 concerns. So we've had our local hotels working with us, and Bernalillo County has stepped up to the plate and are actually operating some hotels to accommodate these people and get them off the streets and get them the care that they truly need and deserve. So there's just been a lot going on, and I know you all are no strangers to it, know all the challenges that are involved. And like I say, we just can't do it without our partners, and we just appreciate the opportunity to be a part of the amazing work that you all do. So at this time, I want to introduce my colleagues, Margarita Chavez Sanchez. She's the director of our behavioral health services with Bernalillo County, and also Gilbert Ramirez. He's the deputy director of family and community services with the city of Albuquerque. There are our fearless leaders and partners within the community to further speak about the collaborative approach to ensure housing and mental health supports and responsive in tackling the COVID-19, and in many ways provide a response template for supports when confronted with future public health emergencies. So I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to Margarita and Gilbert. And again, I thank you all for allowing us to be a part of this very important discussion. Thank you so much.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is Gilbert Ramirez from the city of Albuquerque. Hoping you can all hear me. I want to first start off by saying thank you to County Manager Marcus Baca for that warm introduction and highlighting the collaboration. Also want to extend on behalf of Mayor Tim Keller our gratitude to the First Lady, the City's Thrive Coalition, for allowing us the opportunity to kind of share our work. More importantly, to bring this group together across cities, just to be able to share the information going on during this difficult time. So with that being said, let me jump into the presentation. I believe our first slide is slide 16. And before I get too much into the depth of that, I thought I would start with kind of a 30,000 view of just, you know, our makeup and population and kind of what we're looking at here. Bernalillo County roughly has about 680,000 individuals who live within that county line. The city of Albuquerque is the largest metropolitan city in the state, but of course within that county area with about 560,000 individuals residing within there. Those population statistics are important because it does kind of speak to like who we're working with and how we're serving them. Over 50% of the population within the city is roughly Hispanic or identifies as Hispanic. The second largest population is going to be that of non-Hispanic white individuals. And then we have a very unique and diverse makeup of a distribution of American Indian, African American, and Asian communities that fall within that. Right now, and actually I believe the point in time count, if you're not familiar with that, is kind of a nationwide and other city-wide collective way of kind of gathering information as to what does the homeless population look like in the city. Our selected date is yesterday, so the 25th is going to be a date for this year's study to kind of look at sheltered and unsheltered individuals who are in our community and what that looks like as far as numbers. Given COVID, we're trying to get as most accurate representation of that to kind of see how COVID has affected that and how are we doing, but also to make sure that, you know, people are being represented. And it's going to look a lot different because it's many of our nonprofit partners and volunteers who go out and collect that information, which is huge. And we're having to adapt to that. But let me speak a little bit about what happened in our last count and what that looks like for our city. So on January 2019, when the report came out from our point in time count, there was roughly an estimate of about probably 3,250 individuals, sheltered and unsheltered, who probably were experiencing homelessness within the Bernalillo County area. Of course, that was what could be counted. We understand that probably that number is higher and around 4,500. Of that, 1,500 of those individuals reside within Albuquerque. So that information is just kind of give you a landscape of like who we're dealing with and the individuals who probably were most vulnerable during the time that COVID hit and how that was set to be a response for us. Now, before Mayor Tim Keller came into the administration 3 years ago, The shelter that the city operated, which is the largest, it has capacity for up to 450 bed spaces. It was a winter shelter only. So primarily it was only open during winter months, roughly November to about March, and then it shut down. And it was not a 24-hour shelter. It was evening shelter only and evening shelter hours during the weekend. During this administration, we moved that over to making it year-round, understanding that the needs are throughout, and also moving it to 24 hours around the clock on the weekend, not during the week necessarily. When COVID hit, a lot of adaptations had to be made, and we do now operate our shelter year-round, 24 hours a day, and we provide transportation. Just to give you a little geographical understanding of like the dynamics we had to deal with, our shelter is previously the Metropolitan Jail, and it's been refitted to be a shelter, but it sits 20 miles outside of the downtown area of our city. So you have to understand the transportation coordination that happens in getting individuals out to the shelter. And as we came in, we understood that this shelter system was primarily just warehousing individuals without necessarily a plan of kind of exit. It was a place to provide shelter. It was initially intended just to be winter, and then it evolved. So with that being said, being a licensed clinician myself, exit begins at entry, right? So it's the first time you come in, we already need to start addressing the issue of exit and what those situations look like. What we learned is that so many of the individuals that were in our system, and understand about half of this population is what we would refer as a chronically homeless. So individuals who have been experiencing homelessness for a time period of about 12 months, it doesn't have to be consecutive, but over time, they have continued to cycle out of the system and are dealing with some type of a long-term disability, and that can also relate to mental health and or substance use disorder. Of that population, we know that many of them did report to us that about 43% of them struggle with a substance use disorder. The other 45% of that population reported some type of mental health disorder. And what we don't have accurate data is the crossover of the comorbidity of the both, right? We just didn't have the accurate data on that, but we know it exists, which kind of elevates the need for like why our response had to be very, very clear and kind of calculated. Through the shelter work we were doing and the individuals that were passing through, majority of them, probably 82% of them who stayed at our shelter, which we refer to as the WEC, but it's the Westside Emergency Housing Center, had reported having some type, 82% of them having some type of challenge with either substance use or mental illness. So we know a majority of the people dependent upon the shelter were also going to be experiencing these issues. And what we came together to start to address with both the county, the state, our partners at the UNM Hospital early on was how do we address the need for exit, right? How do we start planning a pathway to success, stability, and exit? And this required a coordinated response. And so early on in 2019, partnerships were developed and amongst the state, amongst the county, and in this investment to really look at how do we start adding services that were required based on what we were seeing at the facility. One of the main areas was medical services. We don't have a licensed medical facility, we're a shelter, but we do know a majority of the individuals were needing some type of recuperative or respite care, meaning they're coming in with chronic health issues. As you are very well, social determinants of health for individuals experiencing homelessness, they're layered. And without that appropriate care, there really wasn't going to be a pathway to exit, stability, and or housing. And so our partnership created the ability for us to come together and really look at how could we do better to assist these individuals. And it really was a model because the shelter's location was so far to bring the services in-house. We did do some renovations and created our first medical clinic ever out at the shelter. And one innovative thing that, that we were able to do is that we, the city doesn't have doctors on staff and the university does, but they're of course required to practice within their realms and area. The city forged a partnership with the Department of Health Medical Reserve Corps. That partnership was huge in allowing us to kind of have medical oversight and coverage for volunteer doctors and anybody who wanted to participate and help to do oversight. It's much like when you see Red Cross come into a disaster relief area and then they bring in the partners. Most cities, and I'll share this with you as a resource, is if you have a medical reserve corps system within your state, it's something to look into if you're running a facility that doesn't have the medical services you need to allow a partnership to happen and then volunteers to come in and out. And it's everywhere from behavioral health as well as medical. So we were looking at the larger picture. I think we were one of the first cities to ever get our shelter approved as a medical reserve care site. And with that, it allowed us to then bring in the appropriate partners with the appropriate assurances and also a tort claim insurance coverage to practice and help us start organizing this. This was crucial as far as development prior to COVID happening because we had much of this already established. The partnerships that came together, the discussions we were having with the county was integrated case management services, which they were willing to leverage funding and a contractor to provide. They also provided some cash assistance for us to be looking at programming. The Department of Health came forward, allowing us to do the Medical Reserve Corps. We started the creation of a system that was going to look at the full wraparound of individuals and the exit. Of course, when COVID hit, that did pivot and change in regards to congregate settings not being the safest for individuals in the shelter. And understanding we hit upwards of 400 people who were residing in our shelter, and we immediately had to pivot and respond by pushing individuals into hotels. So as we started to reduce the census of our shelter site, we had to add on some hotels. And we also ran into the issue of our emergency system. So our three main hospitals, including UNM, Presbyterian, and Lovelace, they had individuals experiencing homelessness who were COVID positive, and they needed an avenue to be able to place individuals for that system of care, recuperative care. And as mentioned in the previous presentation, ongoing long-term effects of COVID are still the issue of what we're trying to deal with and why we have established wellness hotels. So we came together to form a system of care. At the very end of your slides, you'll see a couple of appendix slides. One of them is kind of more of a logic model reference. The other one was really the system we created for all ERs to be able to pipeline somebody from the ER who might be a person under investigation or a PUI and or test positive and place them safely in an area for quarantine and or isolation. And that way they weren't putting the individuals at risk at our actual shelter, so we didn't have to lower the census all the way to zero. Those processes were extremely important. And along the way, what we learned is that as you go into isolation, and those of you who are well aware of serving individuals who are dealing with either substance use disorders or mental health issues, asking someone to quarantine for 14 days to 10 days without the appropriate supports can send them to a level of instability that they may just walk out. We were trying to reduce the impact of AMAs against medical advice discharges from our hotels and also provide the wraparound care that they needed. It led to a conversation with our partners, our nonprofits, our federally qualified health care providers who do street medicine for homeless individuals. And we then modified our system of care to being more that model. We invested more dollars for them to increase their behavioral health services. We allowed them to then check in on individuals who were being cared for at the hotel and isolation times to make sure they had access to that care. Our state, and somebody mentioned last presentation, the state engaged with our peer certified support workers to be able to get a contract where we had peer supports being the first point of contact for individuals entering into that hotel so that they were getting called and contacted by somebody immediately in the room to check on them, to ask them how they were doing, to make sure they were going to make it through this isolation period to avoid public health spread or outbreak or them leaving. They also then were tuned into our street medicine providers to be able to elevate a referral if they saw a behavioral health need and or somebody who was losing perhaps prescription access and they needed their medications renewed and or prescribed, they had the ability to do that. We also formed a partnership with the ERs to make sure that anybody who entered into the hotels were discharged with the appropriate amount of medications to allow them to successfully go through their isolation or quarantine period. That was huge. And then we moved on to having a discussion with our Medicaid-assisted treatment providers to make sure that, you know, Suboxone and Methadone were being accessible and that they could lower some of their stringent requirements for the person to actually show up, that they were allowing flexibility in collaboration with the state and the state regulation to build a system in which they could deliver and have 30-party access while they were being placed in this wellness hotel or isolation hotel. So as I speak to these hotels, I do want to say the broader picture is that we ended up having two hotels designated for people of isolation, quarantine, or people under investigation for that COVID positive. We had one designated for, you know, first responders and medical care providers. We had another one just for individuals in the streets, and we did utilize a lot of that for homeless population. We then transitioned them back into either the shelter if they were COVID recovered, and or what we established were three wellness hotels. And like the county manager mentioned, We have three wellness hotels, one primarily focused on families and children, the other two on more fragile and elderly individuals who are more at risk and probably wouldn't be thriving well in a congregate setting, but also had other layered, complicated long-term effects. So that respite recuperative care model to keep them in there and supported while we had street medicine outreach teams going to them to make sure that they were successful. However, I will share that, you know, while everybody was pivoting to mitigate COVID in their facilities and congregate care settings, we did see a gap in the area of individuals responding to care for COVID positive individuals in their facilities and how that was being stood up. Many agencies were not prepared and or ready to do that. And so we were seeing them being discharged to the street, discharged to the shelters, or even displaced in hotels, which we couldn't meet all of the areas of care depending on the acuity. So more recently, we were able to forge a partnership, and I'll let kind of Margarita highlight this, both with investments from the city and the county to bring a partner in who was willing to do more acute care with COVID positive individuals who were exiting probably a hospital care facility that needed to be transferred over. So building that network of care was so huge. And some of our pivotal collaboration pieces, we could not have done this with our nonprofit, without the state participation, without the county coming forward to kind of support this level of care for individuals who are experiencing homelessness. I will say, prior to COVID, we had hit numbers in our shelter of up to 400 individuals. As of today, we are over 750 individuals that are in some way or capacity being served by our wellness motels and the shelter. We've seen a huge spike in families. We saw roughly 20 families being served previously, we're up to probably over 90 families and 186 children attached to them. So understanding that we have individuals from all kind of pathways who now are experiencing these challenges, and we're working to support them into those appropriate places. But again, focusing on continued access to behavioral health care, it would not have been possible without our peers being the first points of contact and then the referral sources. Now I want to pivot over to Margarita to kind of highlight what was done with the Care Campus facility that does address the more severe clients who are needing substance use detox, as well as the county investments in partnership with us. So with that, Margarita, all yours.
Sure. Thank you, Gilbert. And in the interest of time, I know we only have 2 minutes left before it's time for question and answer. I will keep things extremely high level always the last slide has our contact information, so if folks have more detailed questions about the work that we're doing in Bernalillo County, I'm happy to provide more details. But as Gilbert mentioned, you know, COVID has really allowed us to look at the behavioral health impacts of the community through a new lens. And to be honest, we are now preparing for a post-pandemic epidemic, right, in the behavioral health space because of the projected increased demand for behavioral health services across the age spectrum. And we know that that's a significant component that we need to plan on. So I really just want to take a moment to commend our partners out in New York City and Dr. Long and their work in really prepping for providing the supports in the behavioral health continuum. So here in Bernalillo County, we operate a number of direct services, our public inebriate, our social model detox program, supportive aftercare or a sober living, and our crisis stabilization. And these services have been in place prior to COVID, but as you all can imagine, we've had to do some significant shifts in order to accommodate and accommodate needs and mitigate COVID-19 risks. What we have really seen is the demand for services has increased significantly. However, what we are seeing, and it's important to just recognize, is that now 10 months into the pandemic, we are absolutely beginning to see the provider burnout and the provider-based mental health service demand. So all of our staff and our teams that we work with in the community are really seeing an increased demand for supports for their teams. So I think we all do a really great job about thinking how we bring services to the clients we serve in the community, but we have to ensure that we are doing our same diligence by the people that are doing the work on the front line, including our behavioral health professionals. You know, here in the county, we have seen threefold increases in demand for services, and again, significant expansion of our telehealth-based services. Again, that's happening across the country. Fortunately, the state, second week of the pandemic, the state flipped the switch and allowed for Medicaid reimbursement for telehealth services that was not previously a billable service, and so that has been really helpful. And we have had some flexibility around utilizing federal CARES dollars to provide some grants to our community-based behavioral health providers in need. As Gilbert mentioned, the county, the city of Albuquerque, and the state of New Mexico partnered in all dedicated funding to support one of our local behavioral health hospitals to open a COVID wing, because we have, again, as Gilbert mentioned, seen significant gaps in our providers having the capacity to serve COVID-positive clients. So a lot of our providers have been putting COVID mitigation processes in place, but where do we take someone who's needing, inpatient detox or inpatient psychiatric services that cannot traditionally be in a quote-unquote non-COVID unit? And so that collaboration has given us an opportunity to provide care for these clients. So again, in an effort to give at least a minute or two for questions, really high flyby conversation of what we're doing here, but always happy to share more information. Our website also, burnco.gov/DVHS, has good info on everything that we're working on. And with that, I'll just kind of turn it back to our City Strive folks.
Great. Thank you so much. Thank you to the county manager, Gilbert Margarita, for that presentation. It's just such a great example of just how different levels of government, city, county, state, are partnering to really provide a continuum of services in this particular environment that we're in. So thank you so much for sharing that. And just for those of you who might be wondering, Gilbert mentioned some templates and things that he shared at the end of the presentation. That's actually slides 29 and 30. So just want to thank you all for sharing kind of your flow chart and all of the more technical things that are helpful to folks who are thinking about this. So with that, I do want to just leave the last couple of minutes for questions. So I will just open it up. I won't start asking questions. I really want to ensure that we hear from people on this call. So if you have a question, again, just unmute your line by hitting star twice. And if you can just introduce yourself and share what city you're from, that would be great. All right. I hear silence, so maybe I will jump in with a question and just start things off and see if we have at least one other person who has a burning question in mind. I thought what you shared around your peer support was just incredibly helpful. Can you talk a little bit about, I know that was something that you stood up prior to COVID, but can you talk a little bit about how you set that up and kind of what it feels like to be, you know, a client and kind of, you know, get that first that first contact from a peer support team member and just what that looks like through your time in a wellness hotel?
Absolutely. Thank you for that question. So the state did help stand up various motels throughout the state, not just our city, our county. With that being said, we were so appreciative that they entered into a contract with an organization that had certified support peer workers. And the process or logistics is upon entry, within hours, it's kind of like when you check into the hotel, that list is shared with our peer supports. And within an hour of them settling into the room, they're supposed to get a contact in that room to kind of welcome them, check in on them, and say, how are you doing? What are your needs? Oftentimes, it's a very successful kind of welcome to orientate them both to like what you're going to experience you know, this might be hard. You're going to be there for a length of time. And then here's how we are here to support you. But also to keep that pulse on them. I won't say we never had any individuals who just did not leave against medical advice. You know, it was just too much. They couldn't isolate themselves and or they were dependent upon other things that they needed just to stay well. And they needed access to those. And some of that was not allowed in the hotel, of course, so they had to leave. But we've been able to mitigate most of that by connecting immediately to a peer. So that contact was huge. They've extended that contact now to all of our wellness hotels. So if they're transitioned from that isolation quarantine hotel into a wellness hotel, they follow up with them there to make sure they have that constant connection. And they have also started, we invested some city funding to make sure that we're doing a fast track to housing program. Especially with our families, because we've seen such a boom. So they're working to make sure, do they have any income doing that assessment and all this case management work. So it's been a wonderful partnership, and they have every avenue to then elevate it upon them seeing a mental health issue. They can immediately reach our street outreach teams, get them an appointment rather soon to see someone. And then also if there's a lapse in medications or prescription ran out, they need something filled, then the appropriate psychiatrist can look at that and make sure that the meds are filled.
That's great. Thank you for walking us through that. Very helpful. Other questions from folks on the line? Again, just hit star twice.
This is Margarita from Bernalillo County. I may just, since there's not seeming to be a burning question, I may just add one more thing if I can.
Sure.
What we have really seen, you know, to piggyback off of what Gilbert said, is the demand for case management services has been probably the largest request that we've received, including families looking to providers to learn how to turn on a computer, that now their children have a computer at home and they're doing virtual schooling, including identifying social supports because they've lost their job, a full cadre of social service-based needs. And so I really, you know, think it's important for us to absolutely recognize the role of the case manager, be it peer case manager or non-peer case management. You know, this piece of our workforce has been, in my opinion, the glue that has held things together, and have been the lifeline to really support our community members. And so I just want to kind of give kudos to all the case managers out there and just remind folks how vital that role is. And oftentimes it's maybe unlicensed or uncertified, but these case managers really do speak for and advocate and are the lifelines for the clients that need it the most. And so I just, again, want to throw that out there, remind folks how important that component is.
Very helpful. Thank you for adding that. And I think the point that you made about provider burnout and needing to build in support for those individuals, including behavioral health professionals, is such a good point. I know we don't have time today to dive into that topic, but one that we definitely want to think about for future calls. So thank you for flagging that and bringing it up. I imagine it's something others are thinking about here too. Okay, if there are no final questions, we're a few minutes over, so I will wrap up the call.
I'm sorry if I could interrupt real quick. This is Brian Blad with Pocatello, Idaho. And I just had a real quick question, and maybe it can't be answered. Maybe it's for a future meeting. But we're finding in our area there's a lack of groups for the youth. We talk a lot about our adults and what we're doing with them, but our youth are, you know, 18 and under. We're finding a lot of depression, suicide attempts, things like that that are, I'm confident, compounded with the COVID-19, but it's just another mental illness issue that we have. And I'm just wondering if there's any peer groups, if anybody's experienced the same thing, and what direction and how would we approach that from a logistical standpoint with the youth in the high school age kids.
So I'll just open
Gilbert.
It up. Go ahead, please, Gilbert.
Yeah, so I appreciate that question. In the state of New Mexico, our public education department sits under the state, not necessarily the municipality of the mayor, which may be different. But I know there was a large investment to allow monies to be released to the school districts to add additional mental health services and also be intentional around suicide campaigns. In our city, I know, and Marguerite can speak to this, the county invested quite a bit of dollars for our, we have the largest, well, one of the largest school public school districts that sits right in the city, Albuquerque Public Schools, and the county ended up funding some very intentional dollars around suicide prevention, I think right prior to COVID, Margarita, correct me if I'm wrong, which I think helped establish some protocols. And just being a parent myself of two children, I will share that, you know, my own daughter has struggled with some anxiety and going through this, and the school has been very responsive to making sure she's connected to a therapist and at no cost to our family or even our insurance. So I would say dig into what those systems look like. Our youth are super important to make sure we're supporting them, especially if you're on a primarily virtual platform for your educational environment. They've lost access to those third-party reporters, those third-party check-in individuals, and it's so important to make sure a pulse is being taken for the children and where they're at, and that they know what those either chat numbers are at the statewide level, what they can do online because they're very savvy, and information being pushed out to their parents if they're seeing signs of that. I'm not sure if that helps you in your locality, but I do wish you the best because that is a huge area for concern and also for monitoring.
Thank you.
And just related to that, this is Margarita from Bernalillo County. Happy to talk more offline about the work that we're doing and funding with our public school district here as well.
That would be fantastic. Thank you very much.
Wonderful. I will just quickly add to that in the next 10 seconds here that we can also share some of the work here in New York City. We've recently announced an effort to administer social, academic, and behavioral screenings in some of our hardest hit communities here in New York City, just to get an understanding of what students are bringing in with them when they're come into school, whether that's remote or they're doing it in person, and be able to properly refer them to the services that they may need. So happy to also share a little information on that.
That would be fantastic and helpful as well. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you all for joining us. That really brings us to our time together today. For those of you who are still on, thank you for staying an extra couple of minutes. I just want to quickly thank our speakers from New York City and Albuquerque just for taking the time out of a very incredibly busy schedule to prepare these presentations and share your work. And I just want to thank all of you for joining us. I know how busy everyone is, and I know folks are working overtime to serve their residents, so just appreciate you joining us for this. Last thing I just want to flag before we hop off, we recognize that information and best practice sharing is really a core component of this coalition's mission. So if you have suggestions for topics that we should cover this year, or you want to share, you know, the work that you're doing, please don't hesitate to reach out to us. It's very helpful when we hear from you and hear about the work that you're doing, the challenges, the successes, all of that. It really helps us better shape the topics for these calls. And I think we already have some ideas just from some of the questions that were asked today, but just want to encourage everyone to reach out and share your ideas with us. So with that, we will reach out, we'll follow up and share the next save the date for our February call. And we very much look forward to speaking to everyone then. So thank you again. Stay safe and have a great rest of your day.
Thank you.
Thank you.